I'm Larry Morrow, and this is Take Two, the radio program that looks inside a person's adventure, not so much from the outside in, but the inside out. And in the next 30 minutes, you will discover the inward joy of his heart that married him to the passion of his life and the affirmation of ideals that directed his success. You know, I have found over the years, it's always interesting to learn how successful people arrive at the top of their profession. And in the case of my special guest today, Pete Gideon, my close friend arrived at about midway through his very successful road to the top in the record business to New York City. It's a fascinating story of a young guy from Detroit and how he got started in a business that most people on their way to the pinnacle only dream about. Pete Gideon's story begins in Detroit, and I was lucky enough to see some of it all happen. Hey, Pete, welcome, my friend.
Thank you, Larry.
It's so good. It's so good to have you here. So how are things? And now I should tell people that this show is being recorded out of Arizona. I am in Cleveland, Ohio, and Pete is in California.
So. Mission Viejo. Correct.
So, Pete, it's good to see you, my friend. So, Pete, let's take it back to Detroit. You were born and raised in Detroit, weren't you?
I sure was.
Yeah.
Long time ago. Different time.
Now, what did your mom and dad do?
Well, it's interesting. My mom and dad, my dad came to this country first. He was in Germany and he was a pretty successful engineer. And he came to New York because he recognized what was happening in Europe and Germany particularly at that time. And he came to New York and he ended up settling in Detroit because he got a job as an engineer working for General Motors. He worked for Cadillac, as an engineer. Now, my mom was still living in Germany. So once he got the job, he sent for her, brought her over. And it's a, that's an amazing story in itself. But she came and they settled in Detroit. Bought their first house, and I was born, in Detroit, and it was just a very interesting upbringing. My dad, as I said, was an engineer, but I really didn't know the man. He passed away, unfortunately, when I was seven. In today's world, that would not have happened. Medicine has gone so much farther, so far advanced, but he had a heart problem, and he passed away. My mom never worked a day in her life before that, and so she had to go to work, and she did. And consequently, I was one of those lucky latchkey kids who grew up on the street, and I don't think I would have traded it for anything. I mean, it was so different than bringing up children today. I was brought up in the late 40s, 50s, but you know about those times. You know, you were also.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a different, everything was different.
Now, Pete, of course, because Detroit is the home of the automobile industry. Did you ever work at the automobile industry? Did you work on the Corvair or the Cadillac or the Ford or the Buick?
Are you asking me that question because you know the answer?
Yes.
Yeah, I did. I was still in high school. And my best friend at the time, his dad worked at Chrysler. And they had an assembly line. And, I think we were 17 years old. And you weren't supposed to be working at an automobile plant at 17 years old. I don't even think they had insurance or whatever. But somehow or other, he got us a job working on the assembly line at Chrysler. And we would stand in this well all day long. And Chryslers would come to us, the hood would be open, and there would be holes punched in the hood of these cars as they came by. And all day long, Larry, using our best brain power, I would put C-H-R-Y on my side of the hood, and he would put S-L-E-R. On his side of the hood, and you couldn't even misspell it because the prongs, the C was set a certain way, the H You didn't even have to know how to read or write to do this job. Well, after summer vacation, I think we both swore we'd never, ever, ever do it again. Really interesting job, but no thank you.
Well, you know, those of us who lived and worked around Detroit, if you didn't know someone within the automobile industry who worked there, you were bound to be there. And I'll never forget, my first job was working at the Corvair plant at Willow Run Airport, making the old Corvair. And Pete, you're right. You know, a car would come by every 60 seconds. And within that 60-second period, you had to do whatever you did. And my job was to put on a sill plate. And a sill plate was that a little piece of metal that when you step in a car, it holds down the carpet. And so you'd put that piece of metal down and drill three holes in it, put the three screws on, and wait for the next 30 seconds for the next car to come by. And so we love the automobile industry. But you know, Pete, I don't think at that age that you ever, ever guessed that one day that you would be hanging out with superstars in the entertainment business. And
no way.
Nope. And I, of course, I met you when you were young. And when
I wonder sometimes, Larry, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I wonder, because you're talking about something that I think about often, is our future predetermined, or is it right place, right time?
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are things that here we are in our very young lives working in an automobile plant or wherever. And the next thing you know, you're on a career path.
Yes.
Now, how did that happen? Was that meant to be? I have no idea, but I think about it.
For those who just tuned in, I'm Larry Morrow. This is Take Two. And my very special guest today is Pete Gideon. And you may not know that name unless you're in New York or Chicago or LA or whatever the case might be. But Pete was a very, very popular guy in the record business. And we're about to talk about how he got in and then how he got hanging out and making career paths for superstars that are still around today. So, Pete, so you graduate from high school. And what high school was it in Detroit?
Mumford High School. Mumford High School, the home of some other pretty successful music people, actually, mm-hmm. It turns out. But yeah, it was Mumford High School. And my mom had always told me that, as I mentioned, my dad was an engineer. And she said, you know, your dad was an engineer. I think it would be nice if you were an engineer.
Mm.
I actually, my first, after graduating high school, I went to the University of Michigan for first semester to be an architect. And in those days, Larry, they didn't have computers. I mean, everything was a drawing board, T-squares, you know, the math you would do it in your head, or calculus, whatever you needed to do. And it was really interesting. But Larry, it was as boring as working on an assembly line. It was not for me. I just couldn't do it. The architecture wasn't for me. And in fact, years later, I thought about it. That summer, I came home, and this is where the fate or whatever happens. I was very good friends with one of my neighbors up the street. He was a little bit older than I was. And when I came home from school, he said, you have a job this summer. And I said, actually, I don't. I'm looking for work. I need to make some money this summer. He said, here, go see this guy. He's looking for people to work in the warehouse.
Hmm.
Yeah, I said, thank you. You know, I really appreciate it. And I went and saw the guy. And it was a distributorship. It was a warehouse that was a distributor for Decca Records.
Hmm.
Decca Records, Brunswick Records, and Coral Records. And that really meant a lot of country music. Buddy Holly was there. Jackie Wilson. But I was just loading and unloading trucks and pulling orders, and that was pretty mundane also. So September rolls around, I go back to University of Michigan, and after about 2 months, I told my guidance counselor, I said, you know, I don't really think this is for me. I'm just not happy. There's no windows in here. I'm sitting behind this board. I need to be outside. I want to be with people. And he said, well, perhaps the job isn't for you. Maybe you should be doing something else. It was years later, Larry, that I learned how narrow-minded this particular guidance counselor was. Because had he not been, he would have said, architecture is not just sitting behind a drawing board. It's everything from architectural sales on one end to architectural law on the other end. And like any other business, it's full of opportunities. But he was pretty narrow-minded and kind of said, hey, if this is not where you want to be, maybe you shouldn't be. And I left. My mom was disappointed, and I went back to that distributor, and I said, have you got any jobs? He said, absolutely. If you want to work here, you're more than welcome. And he hired me to work in the front office this time. Now I was no longer in the warehouse. This was the first step on the ladder. And I did it, and it was pretty interesting. And I was making a couple hundred bucks a week, and I felt like a millionaire, you know, because what are we talking, the early, late 50s, early 60s?
Mm-hmm.
That's not making a lot of money, you know, or it was. And then as fate would have it again, I used to hang out a lot with the promotion man. And he would take me to record hops with him. When artists were in town, he would let me join them. And I just absolutely fell in love with all of it. And I got a part-time job working with a disc jockey that was on a radio station in Detroit, WJBK. He was known as Jack the Bellboy at the time. And he hired me every Friday night or Saturday night. There'd be a record hop at Notre Dame High School or someplace in the city. And I know you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And I would have all his equipment in the trunk of my car. He didn't want to be bothered with it. I would go set up the equipment, bring in all the 45s, everything that was needed. He would stroll in and start the hop. And again, it was just, then promotion guys would come by and they would have their artists who would lip sync these hit records they had at the time. And all of that was part of the education of the at the beginning. I don't know. It's serendipitous almost how it all just came to be. And then the promotion man left the company. He went to work in Canada, actually. And I was the youngest person in that particular office and maybe in all of MCA because it was pretty much a different generation. It was an older folks country company. They did have artists like Guy Lombardo and people, Bing Crosby, people like that. They had White Christmas and things. But the company was made up generally of a generation before ours.
Mm-hmm.
And they felt that I could do this job and I could connect better with what was happening with the music. Now, getting started is a whole other story, and there's lots of good ones. And but I kind of did it my way, you know, not to quote Frank Sinatra or anything, but, you know, I called on the littlest radio stations. I called on college radio stations. I sent records to high school radio stations. And all of that, as people started maturing and growing up and finding their career paths, these relationships started to blossom. And it was wonderful. Larry, you were part of that for sure.
Yes.
You were a opening bud on the rose bush. You know, maybe Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting how our careers parallel each other because I, too, went to the University of Michigan. And I, you know, I wanted to be the president of General Motors at that time. Anybody who lived in and around the Detroit area, it was going to end up working in the automobile industry. And I did. And when I worked in the factory, I wanted to be the president of GM until one day I'm driving home from the factory and I hear my favorite disc jockey broadcasting. His name was Joel Sebastian, whom you knew well at WXYZ. And I thought, let me go over and see. He called himself the Swinging Spaniard. So I went over to where he was broadcasting and I pulled up close to the window. He turned around and he looked at me, and somehow it changed my life. From that day forward, I said, that's what I want to do. I want to be a DJ. Yeah. And then, you know, the rest of that story is history. And for those of you just tuning in, I'm Larry Morrow. This is Take Two. And my very special guest today is my old pal, Pete Gideon, who actually was responsible for setting my career on fire in Detroit, Michigan. Pete has probably accomplished everything that any promotion manager in the business could ever accomplish. And for those of you who don't know what that is, a promotion man who is a person who worked at a record company and was responsible for taking all the new records to the radio station so they could vote on them and decide which records they were going to play. So never thinking one day that I would be hanging out with superstars in the entertainment business. But I remember meeting Pete. Pete, you were, I was a young broadcaster in Flint, Michigan, hoping to make it to the big time. And Flint, Michigan at that time was the 65th radio market in America. Well, how do you go from the 65th to into the top 10? So I remember Pete one day came in talking about a record that he had with a brand new group. And Pete, I'm going to let you take it from here. All right?
Sure. I love that story. I mean, first of all, I loved coming to Flint. Working in Detroit was a whole different kind of mindset and attitude. It was a market that didn't take a lot of chances on new artists. So you had to go out and build a story. And the way you did that was you went and you beat the bushes, basically. You sent the record out. You went and visited radio stations. I loved going to Flint. I would go to Flint and Saginaw. I'd go to Ann Arbor and Lansing. I'd go to Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo, you know, wherever there was a tower. And if you knew what the format was, there was a possibility that you could get an ad on one of those stations. And if you knew the business, it wasn't just about getting an ad, but you had to get records into the record stores, because if there was some activity, people wanted to hear it, or the phones rang, or people went into record stores, they had to have it to buy it. So there was a business involved in it. But I remember coming to Flint, and I did have a record by a new act, and I got it. I loved the record. I understood it. Where, again, maybe these people at MCA or at Decca Records at the time, I don't know that they truly understood what they had. It was entirely different from everything else. The record was called I Can't Explain, and it was by The Who. I used to play that record in the office till people came in screaming, shut the damn thing off. You know, I just couldn't get enough of it. And I remember being really passionate about it and asking for favors. Well, what could we do? How about if I give you guys 25 singles? You can give them away on the air. You know, let's make a little contest or something. And there you were, and you were so receptive to it. And quite honestly, you can take the bow for being probably, I mean, we talk about this, but being the very first person that ever played a Who record in the United States.
And the British invasion was on fire at the time. We only knew about the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and me and the Animals, but the Who comes along and they were different. And I do remember, Pete, I heard that record and I said, that thing has got to turn out to be a big million seller. I don't know how many millions they sold, but it was the record that absolutely took them into the business and made them the incredible superstars that they turned out to be.
Yes, it was the start of a career. And I think that they had something unique going for them. When they wrote I Can't Explain, at least I'm told this, they really were writing to a demographic that was, you know, young kid, not young kids, I don't want to say that, early teens, people that, kids that were going through all the angst and all the things that you do when you're turning 14 and whatever, and you can't explain it, and it must be love, and, mm-hmm. you know, and they stutter. It was a marvelous record. I still hear it occasionally. and it never fails to register. Terrific record. And then there was more after that, of course. And then they came to America, and they came in their little British suits that they wore at the time. That was the style. And lo and behold, if, you know, because of where the record was starting to make some noise, as we used to say, make some noise, they planned a tour to be in these cities so that the fan base who liked their records could come see them in person live and see what they were all about. And of course, Flint, Michigan was right there on several major occasions, actually. Mm-hmm. And it was wonderful. I loved Flint.
And for those of you, you know, you hear us talking about Detroit and Flint, Michigan. And anytime a guy, a DJ like myself, when you're in a big market like that, you can hardly wait to get to a bigger market. And of course, I had only been in the business 2 years. So the chances of me of going to a top 10 market would have been slim and none until one day Pete came to me and he said, Larry, he said, I have a relationship with the program director at CKLW in the Detroit area, a 50,000 watt gigantic radio station. And so, Pete, why don't you take it from there?
Yeah, that was wonderful, too. Again, serendipity, you know.
Yeah.
Is it meant to be, or is it right place at the right time? I don't know. But John Gordon was the program director at the time. And he was also a little elderly, if you will. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had gray hair. Of course, we all have gray hair or no hair now. Mm-hmm. But back then, you know, you thought that was pretty old. And I knew from my relationships with the people at the station and seeing John on a weekly basis that they were going to be making some changes at that radio station. They were particularly looking for somebody to do nights at CKLW. Now, as you said, it's 50,000 watts. If the listeners don't know this, 50,000 watts at night can reach 22 states.
Mm-hmm.
And there were people that listened to it loyally. I think at one time it was the number one radio station in Cleveland.
Yes, it was. Right.
And Buffalo. And you could pick them up in Memphis. You could get them all many, many places in the country. And they had fans everywhere. Now, CKLW was called a Detroit station, but the reality was they weren't in Detroit, they were in Windsor. In fact, they weren't even in the United States.
You're right.
Canada,
you're right.
You know? So as odd as that is. So he told me he was looking for somebody. And I remember that we had I don't know if it was in person or on the phone. I can't remember exactly. But I thought, hey, this is something you might really be interested in. And 2 years or not, it's about how you present yourself, your voice, you know, your knowledge. And why not give it a try? See what happens. The worst he can tell you is no.
Yes.
So then didn't you set up a...
I auditioned for it, and they hired me. And it was the biggest break in radio. And it would be unheard of for anyone to go from the 65th market to a top five market at a big 50,000-watt station, as you said, heard halfway around the country. And in parts of the world you wouldn't believe. And here I am working on the all-night show. Here's the sad part about this story is that I was so excited about telling everyone, and my family and my friends, tune in to hear Larry Morrow on CKLW. And about 10 minutes before I went on the air, the program director who's in charge of all the DJs walked in and he said, Larry, we got a great idea. Since we're in Windsor, and the Duke of Windsor is the king around here, we're changing your name to Duke Windsor. And I said, no, you can't. Not now. Not now. And so I went on the air. I took the nickname for myself, calling myself the Duker. And that nickname stuck with me for my entire career. But it was you, Pete, who set that whole thing in in motion. For those of you who just tuned in, you're listening to Take Two. I'm Larry Morrow. My very special guest is Pete Gideon. Now, we haven't unleashed everything about Pete's career, but in part two of our interview, which you will hear next week, Pete talks about all the superstars he met in the business and how he went from Cleveland to New York City and became one of the most important people on the face of the planet in terms of the record business. That's Saturday morning at 9:30 on 1220 and Sunday afternoon on 1420, The Answer. Let me know that you're listening and tell a friend about our new radio program. So until next time, do all the good you can to everyone you can, every time you can. This is Take Two, and I'm Larry Morrow.